From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The current focus of the Catholic Church's problems is the sex abuse crisis. Father Donald Cousins writes about this crisis in his new book, Sacred Silence, Denial and the Crisis in the Church. He also writes about what he sees as an underlying crisis, the Church's unwillingness to change in ways that could better address the contemporary world. On today's Fresh Air, Cousins reflects on some of his own experiences as a priest. The great singer-songwriter and guitarist Richard Thompson has been performing a show that he calls A Thousand Years of Pop Music. It includes his interpretations of a Shakespearean song and a Britney Spears hit. He'll perform a few songs from the show for us. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. One of the two men arrested overnight in connection with a sniper rampage in the Washington, D.C. area is slated to appear in court tonight. 41-year-old John Allen Muhammad is being held on a charge of violating a restraining order by possessing a weapon. Meanwhile, authorities say changes made to the car that the men were driving may have made it possible for a gunman to fire a weapon without being seen. NPR's Brian Naylor has more.
There are reports that the car that the two gentlemen, Mr. Muhammad and Mr. Malvo, were found in early this morning had been modified so that someone could crawl into the trunk and shoot from inside the trunk without having to step out of the car. It appears that that may have been the method of some of the shootings, but not all of them.
NPR's Brian Naylor reporting. Muhammad was detained along with 17-year-old John Lee Malvo, both found in a Chevy Caprice at a highway rest stop in Maryland early this morning. Meanwhile, in Clinton, Maryland, where John Allen Muhammad, also known as John Allen Williams, once lived, residents say they recognize the man's picture and know his former wife and children. NPR's Andrea Seabrook has more from Clinton.
Several neighbors say they remember seeing the man jog every day when he was here, but they haven't seen him in several months now. Neighbors say they moved here in early 2001 from Washington State. The residents of this quiet townhouse development are very surprised that the media have descended on their community. None of them expected the sniper case to lead here, though some now say it explains the stepped-up patrols and surveillance of the neighborhood in the last 2 days by unmarked police cars. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Clinton, Maryland.
Dozens of armed Chechen rebels continue to hold hundreds of people hostage in a theater in Moscow. The audience was taken hostage yesterday. Earlier today, the body of a woman shot to death was wheeled from the building, and the rebels threaten more deaths if authorities try to storm the theater. Some of the hostages had been able to make cell phone calls to people outside the building. Some witnesses say the rebels have been making demands for Russia to end its war with Chechnya. The U.S. continues to run into a brick wall, getting a toughened resolution on Iraq backed in the United Nations. France appears ready to talk, but Russia isn't budging. A Security Council vote aimed at forcing Iraq to comply with U.N. demands to disarm or face serious consequences could come sometime next week. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 177 points to 8,317 in heavy trading of about 1.7 billion shares. The Nasdaq closed down 21 points to 1,298. The S&P 500 also down 13 points. This is NPR. Union Carbide, a division of Dow Chemical Company, has been found legally liable for exposing thousands of workers to potentially cancer-causing asbestos. The verdict from the six-member jury panel potentially clears the way for millions of dollars in damage claims against the company. NPR's Jack Spear has more.
In a month-long trial, which initially involved around 8,000 plaintiffs and 250 corporate defendants, it ultimately came down to just one company, Union Carbide, and whether the firm knowingly exposed workers at its plants to asbestos. The six-member jury panel, after deliberations, decided the company was aware workers were being exposed over a 35-year period ending in 1980. However, in a partial victory for Union Carbide, the jury also determined there was no conspiracy on the part of the company to deliberately deceive the public. The decision clears the way for as many as 1,000 plaintiffs to now seek monetary damages. Other corporate defendants in the case, including firms like ExxonMobil and Honeywell, settled charges, leaving Union Carbide as the only defendant. The company has said it will appeal. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
The West Nile virus has claimed two more lives in Illinois, bringing the state's death toll from the disease to 45. State health officials announced today that the latest victims are a 70-year-old man and an 81-year-old woman. They died earlier this month. Illinois also says there are 8 new human cases of the disease. At least one person is dead, several others injured in Texas after a tornado hit Corpus Christi. The twister left extensive damage at the west campus of Del Mar College. A middle school also suffered some damage. Some vehicles were overturned by heavy flooding. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Americans for Balanced Energy Choices, educating Americans on the issues of affordable electricity from coal and a cleaner environment. BalancedEnergy.org.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com by this and other NPR member stations. And Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Half a Life by V.S. Naipaul, author of Enigma of Arrival and A House for Mr. Biswas.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Donald Cousins, is a priest who has written reflective books about what it's like to be a priest today. He's the author of The Changing Face of the Priesthood, a reflection on the priest's crisis of soul, and the new book, Sacred Silence, Denial and the Crisis in the Church. The book reflects on the current sex abuse scandal, but Cousins also writes about what he sees as a systemic problem, a still feudal church is struggling to meet the modern world. Cousins is the former secretary and vicar for clergy and religious at the Diocese of Cleveland. He now teaches religious studies at John Carroll University. Yesterday, the Vatican announced its appointments to a new commission which will revise the bishop's zero-tolerance policy for priests accused of sexual abuse. The Vatican opposes zero-tolerance because it ignores the Church's statute of limitations, doesn't protect the due process rights of accused priests, and defines sexual abuse too ambiguously. Cousins sees a positive and negative side to overturning zero tolerance.
Many priests today feel that they have been put in grave danger with that Dallas policy. And I think the Vatican was right to acknowledge that the definition of sexual abuse was very, very broad. There was no distinction between, say, a priest who makes an inappropriate remark to a teenager and between a priest who has a sexual experience with a teenager. So from that perspective, I'm glad the Vatican vetoed or at least called into question a good deal of the Dallas policy. From the negative side, it tells me that the Vatican still does not understand the church in the U.S. For example, the Vatican policy was critical of the bishops because they indicated that they would report to the authorities allegations of sexual misconduct. Well, that's the law, and we have to have the bishops conforming to law in this country. So there is a positive side to this action by the Vatican and also a negative side that tells me the Vatican doesn't understand the real nature of the church here in the United States.
How do you think the church should deal with priests accused of sexual abuse?
Well, first of all, they need to deal with priests accused of sexual abuse according to the law. Failure to do so is going to put children at risk, and it is going to further diminish their own credibility. I think if a priest is a true pedophile, an adult, usually a male, who is consistently and attracted sexually to prepubescent children, that man should never do ministry again. That doesn't mean he has to be drummed out of the priesthood, but he should never be allowed to have any kind of contact with parishioners in general and children in particular.
Why doesn't it mean he should be drummed out of the priesthood?
Our theology teaches that once a man is ordained a priest, he remains a priest until he dies. when people say a man should be thrown out of the priesthood, they are talking about a process that has been commonly referred to as defrocking of the priest. So in a sense, you throw him out of the priesthood. He's not allowed to wear clerical clothes. He's not to be allowed to be addressed as father. Whatever is necessary for the safety of children and teenagers should be done. If a priest is found guilty of gross sexual imposition on a young child or a teenager, he should never be allowed to minister again as a priest. And in some cases, that does require that he be defrocked. But I think that in many cases, a priest doesn't have to suffer that indignity of being defrocked. I'm for defrocking priests if the safety of teenagers and children requires it.
My guest is Donald Cousins. He is a priest in the Cleveland Diocese. He teaches at John Carroll University in the Cleveland area. His new book is called Sacred Silence, Denial and the Crisis in the Church. In writing about the sexual abuse scandal in the church, you write about how the church is trying to reconcile itself with the modern world, and that leads you to discuss that process when you were first being ordained in the mid-60s. And before you were ordained, you had to take an oath dating back to 1910.
The oath against modernism.
What was that about?
Well, the church was very threatened with the initiatives taken by the Enlightenment or the designers of the Enlightenment that go back centuries. And so the whole scientific thrust of a rational approach to life was very upsetting to many church authorities. In the area of scripture scholarship especially, there was concern that we would be unfaithful to that which was revealed by God. So to maintain the faith and the purity of the faith, bishops, clergy, seminarians about to be ordained, anyone being appointed to a church office was required to take the oath against modernism. It's a marvelous example of fear and anxiety and an attempt to control what people think and believe, which over the long run certainly hasn't worked at all. So priests between 1910 and 1967 were asked to take an oath against modernism just before they were ordained. And if you were teaching at a seminary or a pontifical university, you were required to take that oath every fall before the academic year began.
And what did you have to promise when you took the oath?
Well, you had to promise to accept the teaching of the church as it was determined by the Vatican, as it was determined by the tradition of the church and the teaching office of the church, as if there would be no new developments or new insights. We were asked to swear that we believed that the author of the Pentateuch was Moses, even though scripture scholars were very confident that the authorship of the Pentateuch was quite different. I think it's fair to say that seminarians before 1965 were not really encouraged to think critically, to challenge the propositions presented to them in the seminary. You might say that it was a form of apologetics. We were in the seminary to learn what the church taught, how to defend it, and how to argue it persuasively. And so it wasn't really a true graduate school. Now, to an extent, I understand that you do need to train future priests to present clearly and in a compelling way the teachings of the church. But God help us if our priests are not free to think critically. That should serve the truth, not threaten it.
Did you ever consider not taking the oath against modernism?
I was very disturbed when the oath was put before me, and I think some of my classmates were, although I certainly can't speak for them. I don't believe I considered not signing the oath for any considerable amount of time, and I'm not proud to say that. I think it is a very good example of my own denial and the denial of my classmates. We compromised, and we signed the oath. We who were to be preachers of the truth, men who were to be trusted, men whose word was all important, we began our priesthood with an oath that we really didn't believe.
When the Second Vatican Council made its changes and the Oath of Modernism was rescinded, did it make you think that the Church's rules were more arbitrary, that they were the rules of men, not God, and they were changeable, they were subject to political processes, you know, a rule may come and go in your own lifetime?
I think most priests and the laity were able to make a distinction between rules that were created by the Church, rules that seem to be part of our tradition, and those teachings of the Church that were clearly the result of what we believe to be divine revelation. And so you have to make a distinction between rules that are apparently from God and rules that have come to us down through the centuries created by Church officials. The most clear example of a rule that has not been revealed to us by God would be mandatory celibacy for diocesan priests in the Latin Rite.
How has your view of the celibate life changed as you've gotten older? Has it changed?
It has changed. It remains a mystery to me. I think there is a wonderful richness to the celibate life, and I think we'll have it with the Church throughout the Church's history. A number of young men today and older men are studying for the priesthood in religious congregations or religious communities, communities like the Benedictines, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, and the Jesuits. These men want to be priests, and they choose to be celibate because they want to live in a religious community and engage in the ministry that has been traditionally associated with their religious congregation. We will always, in my judgment, have celibate priests. The issue for me is the necessity of mandatory celibacy for the diocesan priest. While it's a blessing in many ways, and I've tried to write positively about the effect of celibacy in the diocesan priest's life, it takes a real toll. There's a certain part of life that allows each of us to experience human suffering. There's no escaping human suffering, but unnecessary suffering should never be embraced. I think there's a great deal of emotional suffering, especially the suffering of loneliness, in mandatory celibacy for diocesan priests.
Do you think that loneliness gets any easier or more difficult as the priest gets older? Does the priest, in your experience or in your personal experience, have you felt any more connected or less connected to other people with age?
I'm going to mention a kind of progression, and this certainly has all kinds of exceptions. But for the young priest, maybe between the ages of 25 and 35 or so, often the difficulty of celibacy is the absence of a sexual life, an active sexual life. And then in the middle years of the priest, very often the pain of celibacy is not having children, a son and daughter or sons and daughters that make up a family. And then as the priest moves into his late middle years and older, very often the pain of celibacy is not having someone with whom you can share your life. I think the loneliness factor is constant throughout all three of these more or less stages that I've mentioned. But it can become especially strong in the late middle years and senior years of a priest's life.
If a church wanted to change the mandatory celibacy for priests, what would it have to do to make that change?
The church is an ecclesiastical monarchy. So the Pope, with his signature on a document could change mandatory celibacy for diocesan priests that quickly.
If there was a new ruling that say, priests, you can get married whenever you want to. It doesn't have to even be before you're ordained. If you want to get married now, you can, and you can remain a priest. Is that something you would hope to do?
The paradox is that I have found my life to be remarkably rich and filled with close friends. I know the joy and support of a wonderful family. So I can't say that without question I would marry. But my own theology of celibacy is such that I believe I would pray to have the wisdom to know whether or not I was being called to marriage.
Father Donald Cousins is the author of the new book, Sacred Silence, Denial, and the Crisis in the Church. He teaches at John Carroll University. This is Fresh Air. We often invite religious leaders on our show not to preach to you or try to convert you, but to reflect on leading the spiritual life and both the profound and mundane issues they face in that life. We hope you'll support this type of reflection by calling your station with a pledge. We thank you for your support. My guest, Donald Cousins, is a priest who also writes about the lives of priests. His new book is called Sacred Silence. Donald Cousins, your new book, Sacred Silence, is subtitled Denial and the Crisis in the Church. In what parts of the church life do you think it's in denial?
I think that in terms of the crisis that we are now talking about in terms of sexual abuse of minors and children, there is a fair amount of denial. And I think in many other areas of the church, the vocation crisis, for example. Our seminaries are probably only half filled at the present time. Our novitiates, where young women prepare for lives as nuns and sisters, they're not full either. And until recently, there was a fair amount of denial that there were fairly large numbers of gay men in the priesthood and in our seminaries. When the Changing Face of the Priesthood came out 2 years ago, the book was both widely praised and also strongly condemned, especially in certain church circles. I think much of that negative reaction to the book was due to a sense that we can't face certain issues right now because it would harm the church. We've done far more harm towards the priesthood than we've harmed the reputation of the church by being so afraid to honestly, compassionately, and respectfully address issues that need to be addressed.
You mentioned the issue of homosexuality in the church. I think that must be a particularly hard issue for you to discuss. I think I've read enough of your work to know that you're not homophobic, but to raise the issue that perhaps there's a proportionately large population of gay men in the priesthood and to wonder about what that means for the priesthood might put you in the position of looking homophobic, like it's something you're worried about. Can you talk a little bit about the difficulties of trying to talk about that in an open way?
Well, it's very difficult to talk about the issue of homosexuality and the priesthood in the seminaries today, precisely, Terry, because of what you've just mentioned there, the fear that you'll be identified as homophobic, and I truly hope I am not homophobic. I don't think I am. And I've had a number of gay priests that and some seminarians whom I do not know write to me or call to thank me for raising the issue as I did in the Changing Face of the Priesthood. It's a very tricky subject to address. I do want to say that I think the Vatican has broken through its own denial. The Vatican has recently acknowledged that there is an issue of a higher percentage of gay priests and seminarians than one might anticipate. I'm quite, frankly, very uncomfortable with the Vatican's position that seems to be moving towards a stance that will bar gay men from studies for the priesthood. I think that would be a mistake.
Is that the direction you see it heading in?
I'm afraid I do. The Vatican has already indicated that gay men should not be admitted, and even Dr. Joachim Navarro-Valls, the Vatican spokesperson, has questioned the very validity of the ordination of gay priests. That's going to be very problematic if we move in that direction.
What are some of the problems?
Well, first of all, who determines that an individual has a homosexual orientation? I think that has to come from the individual himself or herself. And in terms of candidates for the priesthood, if a man feels that God is calling him to the priesthood, I think he's going to be put into a situation where he just won't indicate that he happens to have a gay orientation. How do you enforce that kind of a policy that gay men should not be admitted? I also feel it's a problem for gay priests today, committed celibate priests who feel that they are being scapegoated in terms of the sexual abuse scandal. We have so many faithful, effective gay priests and indeed gay bishops that I think it would be a huge administrative problem and a terrible public relations position for the church to assume, should indeed it argue that gay candidates for the priesthood would not be admitted into our seminaries.
In response to the crisis in the church, several new groups have formed, groups of laity, groups of priests. One of the groups of laity is called Voice of the Faithful. And one of the slogans of theirs I've seen is Keep the Faith, Change the Church. Their goals are to support those who've been sexually abused, to support priests of integrity, and to support structural change within the church. As a priest looking at this group, what do you make of it?
I have a great deal of respect for Voices of the Faithful. I think they're trying to set a moderate agenda. I think they precisely want to keep the faith, and they're talking about changing the church in those areas where the church indeed is free to change. A greater role for the laity in the church, appropriate accountability. At the present time, the accountability in the church, as it is in most feudal systems, is upward. But there doesn't seem to be any kind of horizontal accountability or downward accountability. Voices of the Faithful, I think, is aptly named. We're hearing from people who are indeed faithful and who love the church very much. And actually, they're going to point the way out and through the present crisis we're in. I'm convinced of that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you, Terry.
Father Donald Cousins, his new book is called Sacred Silence. This is NPR, National Public Radio. The great singer-songwriter and guitarist Richard Thompson has been doing a show in which he performs some of his favorite songs he didn't write, songs from the past 1,000 years. Coming up, he plays a few for us. Wait till you hear him doing a Britney Spears hit.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Fearsome Doubt, an Inspector Ian Rutledge mystery by Charles Todd, author of Watchers of Time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Richard Thompson's fans, including me, revere him as a great singer, songwriter, and guitarist. He got a start with the late 60s British group The Fairport Convention, which was one of the first groups to combine rock with traditional music of the British Isles. In the late 70s and early 80s, he performed with his wife, Linda Thompson. Since their divorce, he's performed under his own name, continuing to write great songs, often very dark ones, about love gone wrong, accidents, and murders. But recently he's been performing great songs that he didn't write in a show that he first performed at the Getty Museum called A Thousand Years of Pop Music. Included is a Shakespearean song, an aria from a Henry Purcell opera, and songs by Hank Williams, The Beatles, ABBA, and the Britney Spears hit Oops, I Did It Again. In the next few months, he plans to release a CD of these songs through the Internet. We invited Richard Thompson to perform some of these songs for us. Richard Thompson, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Now, the show you're doing is called A Thousand Years of Pop Music. How'd you come up with this idea of doing A Thousand Years of cover tunes?
Well, it was one of America's finest, Hugh Hefner, who phoned and said, you know, could I contribute to a list of the greatest songs of the millennium. They wanted the, you know, the 10 best songs of the millennium. And I know they didn't mean that, you see. I just thought this was very pretentious idea on the part of Playboy, you know. They meant, you know, nothing before Roxy Music, basically. So so I thought, well, I'm going to call their bluff here. I'm going to start in 1000 AD, you know. And so, you know, I found something by St. Godric, you know, very, very fine and popular songwriter of the day. And I worked my way extremely slowly up through the centuries. And I think I had one from the 20th century. And they didn't print mine, but that was the idea for the show. You know, I thought, you know, well, this would be fun to do at the Getty, because the Getty had asked me to do a show that was different from the usual thing, and I didn't want to do a kid's show because they throw things at you.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So that was the idea.
So what's the oldest song in your show?
The oldest song is from about 1060, but it's a song that is by St. Godric. It's called World's Bliss Ne Last, Not Thrower, It Wit and Wend Away Anon. You know, the joy of the world doesn't last. It's pretty depressing, actually. Perhaps I shouldn't sing that one. Perhaps I should do one from about 1240. How would that be?
That would be fine.
Okay. Which is one that's better known. It's more anthologized. Summer Is A-Coming In, which... was written down by a man called John Farnsett, wrote it down in 1240. And he was a monk at Reading Abbey, just outside of London. And his manuscript is still in the British Museum. You can still see his manuscript of the song. It goes something like this. We don't know exactly how it went, but it goes something like this. Oh, it's the first round in the English language. It's the first canon where one person can start and the next person starts later. And there's six parts, and they all interlock beautifully. It's extremely clever. You won't hear quite how clever it is right now. You'll just hear me doing one part.
Summer is a coming in, load a single coo. Grow a seed and blow with me, don't spring the world anew. Sing a coo. You have bleateth after lamb, loth after cover coo. Bullock starteth, buck averteth, Mary sing, cuckoo, 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 well sing the cuckoo, the swicker who never knew. Summer is a coming in, load a sing, cuckoo, grow a seed and blow with me, and spring the word anew. Bleateth after lamb, loth after cavacoo. Bullock starteth, buck averteth, Mary sing cuckoo. Cuckoo, cuckoo, well sings our cuckoo. Ne swicker who never knew.
It's Richard Thompson. And that has several early English words in there that
are quite
archaic.
You bet. Yeah, it's you know, it's that big French influence on the English language. So, you know, I think it's more French than English. It's strange. I'm trying to pronounce it in what we think was the right way. We don't really know.
When you were going back and doing the research for these songs, mm-hmm. and finding a lot of early melodies that mm-hmm. you wanted to do, did you start learning new things about music?
Well, I did.
And seeing connections that you'd never seen before.
I think so. I think one of the joys of doing that show was finding what was popular music, in some cases extremely popular, you know, mm-hmm. That would have crossed countries, you know, would have been known all over Europe. For finding songs that had kind of been jettisoned along the way, at some point their popularity had waned. And in some cases, you know, the baby had been thrown out with the bathwater. You know, there were virtues in older music that sometimes got lost or discarded. And when you go back, you think, well, that's a great idea. It's funny that didn't last any longer than it did, you know. So that's been the fun of it.
I'm going to ask you to skip ahead a few hundred years and to do a song that comes out of the jazz tradition. And I know you've listened to a lot of jazz over the years, but I don't usually hear you performing jazz songs.
There's a reason for that.
Are we going to hear an illustration of the reason for that?
Well, yeah, maybe.
Well, this is I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter. Why are you singing it?
I'm singing it because my father was a great Fats Waller fan. You know, he had a nice pile of Fats Waller 78s, and it was always around the house. Just wonderful music, and I've always loved it. It's very warm music. Yeah, very very warm and joyful. And
wanna sing
I suppose it's fun to sing. I'll have a go. I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter. And make believe it came from you. I'm gonna write words oh so sweet. They're gonna knock me off my feet. Lots of kisses at the bottom. I'll be glad I've got them. I'm gonna smile and say I hope you're feeling better. And close with love the way you do. The way you do. I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter. Make believe it came from you. Sit right down, write myself a letter. Make believe it came from you. I'm gonna write words oh so sweet. They're gonna knock me off my feet. Kisses at the bottom. I'll be glad I've got them. I'm gonna smile and say I hope you're feeling better. And close with love the way you do. I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter. I make believe it came from you.
Oh, that was great. That was great fun. Richard Thompson. And he's been doing a show called 1,000 Years of Pop Music, in which he finds known and obscure songs from the past 1,000 years. Nowadays, when people want to illustrate how bad certain pop music is, they will use as an example, Oops, I Did It Again, the big hit by Britney Spears.
Would they do that, really? Well,
yeah,
that's a shame.
You have taken that song and you're doing it in your show. Obviously, there's something that you really like about the song or the record.
Well, I think it's a good song. I think it's somewhat in the Swedish pop tradition. As far as I know, the songs are written and recorded in Sweden, and then they get flown over to the States, and Britney puts the voice on, and then they fly them back and produce them, and the results are mega, you know. I kind of like Swedish pop music, you know, the Cardigans and ABBA and what have you, you know. And I think it's kind of a good song, and it's quite witty in its own way. And I don't think it's terrible. I could find a lot more terrible songs around these days than this.
Well, why don't you do it for us?
Okay. I think I did it again. I made you believe we're more than just friends. It might seem like a crush, but that doesn't mean that I'm serious. But to lose all my senses, it's just so typically me. Ooh, baby, baby, oops, I did it again. I played with your heart, got lost in the game. Ooh, baby, baby, oops, you think I'm in love, that I'm sent from above. I'm not that innocent. My problem is this, I'm dreaming away, wishing that heroes truly exist. I cry watching the days, you see I'm a fool in so many ways. But to lose all my senses, that's just so typically me. Baby, baby, oops, I did it again. I played with your heart, got lost in the game. Ooh, baby, baby, oops, you think I'm in love, that I'm sent from above. I'm not that innocent.
That's good.
It's not so bad, is it?
Yeah, that's very good. So what made you think about doing the song?
I'd love to say it was my idea. It wasn't. It was suggested by a friend of mine, you know, who kind of sat me down and said, you know, said, yeah, right, okay, you got to listen to this. You know, think what you could do with this. Here's the video, you know, check this out, you know. So I didn't get all the dance moves down, but, you know, musically I got a bit of a grasp of it, I think.
My guest is Richard Thompson. He'll perform more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Richard Thompson. He's joining us to perform some of the songs from a show he's been doing called A Thousand Years of Pop Music. Now, in your show of A Thousand Years of Pop Music, in which you do covers of centuries worth of music, you include some of your own songs, too.
No, I don't. No.
You don't?
No.
Oh, I thought you did.
No, that would be
cheating.
Even more pretentious than it already is.
Oh, well, can I ask you, in spite of that... Despite the fact that you don't do it in the show, would you do one of those for us, one of your own songs?
Oh, okay. Let me see what would be good. Okay, I'll do an early one. This is it's from 72, I think. I think 1972. This cruel country has driven me down. Tis me and lying. Tis me and lying. Only sad stories to tell to this town. My dreams things are withered and died. Once I was bending the tops of the trees, kind words in my ear, kind faces to see. Then I struck up with a guy from the west, played run and hide, played run and hide. Count to 1 to 10, and she's gone with the rest. My dreams are withered and died. Silver moon sail up and silver moon shine on the water so wide, on the water so wide. Steal from the bed of some good friend of mine. My dreams are withered and dying. If I was a butterfly, live for a day, then I could be free, just blowing away. This cruel country has driven me down, teasing me and lying, teasing me. Only sad stories to tell to this town. My dreams are withered and die. My dreams are withered and die. My dreams are withered and die.
Inspired that song?
I don't know. I think just listening to folk music, traditional music, and then just writing something. I'm not sure I remember having an object to the song.
Listening to folk music for you seems to have led you in very dark directions through your songwriting career. I mean, one of the things you've really picked up on, I think, is like the strain of murder ballads and heartbreak and disillusionment in the history of folk music.
Well, I think you've hit on the real fun of folk music.
No, because some people think
the good
folk
stuff.
Music is,
yeah.
is being more...
It's just the happy stuff.
Yeah, that's right. It's being more positive. And
well, I think it is positive. You know, traditional music is dance music and it's uplifting music, but it's also sad. And sometimes the sad music is the sweetest. It's the most beautiful. And also, it was really the newspaper, you know, before people really could read that well, but before news was disseminated in other media, the ballad was how you heard about this murder or that murder or this battle and that victory and, this political crisis, you know, this politician who needed lampooning. It was really spreading the news. And a lot of it is pretty dark, and a lot of it's dark for no good reason. Some of the Scottish ballads are extremely strange and creepy, and about the supernatural, and strange goings on, and fairies and demons, and God knows what. And it's just plain weird stuff. And I suppose because I enjoy that music, it's really. Something that I regurgitate.
Singer, songwriter, and guitarist Richard Thompson. He has many CDs. Sometime in the next few months, he expects to release a CD through the internet that will include music from his show, A Thousand Years of Pop Music. This is Fresh Air. I'm so grateful to the performers like Richard Thompson who have joined us on Fresh Air and introduced us to new songs, rediscovered old songs, and found surprises within familiar songs. Public radio has a very important place in American culture now, presenting musicians, writers, actors, artists, often people whose work has no place on commercial media. Our programming is based on the fact that instead of playing commercials, our support comes from our listeners. I urge you to call now with a pledge. Thank you. My guest is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Richard Thompson. Your family's in music now. Your son is performing on his own, Teddy Thompson. He's also performing with you sometimes in concerts. And your ex-wife, Linda Thompson, is recording again after a long hiatus.
Yes.
And you're even on one track on her new CD. Was that odd for you to be singing together again after all these years?
Well, it was strange. I'd love to say we were singing together. We weren't in the same room at the same time. It was one of those recording things where the tape had to whiz around the world to get everybody on it. But I was glad to do it. It was great. You know, I'm glad to see her working again. She was terrific. And I think in her band, one of my daughters, Camila, is going to be in the band as well, who's also a really good singer and songwriter.
One of your songs that goes through my mind sometimes when I'm thinking a lot about risk or fear or things like that, and I'm sure this isn't really what you were thinking of when you wrote it, is Wall of Death, which...
Well, I was, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of those songs that's a kind of memo to self. it's to remind me to not be complacent. It's to remind me to take risks and live on the edge, which, of course, I never do. But at least when I sing it, I'm reminding myself that that's what I should be doing.
And it's literally about an amusement park, right?
Yeah, there was a famous amusement park in a town called Southend-on-Sea in England, in southeast England. There was a place called the Kurzel, which had all these rides were in the Kurzel.
And was it a ride that you used to go on?
Yeah, the ride in the Kurzel wasn't a real wall of death. I think they often call it a cyclotron. It's a thing that spins you around very fast until you're pinned to the wall. And I think in the Kurzel, that's what they called the cyclotron. They call it the wall of death. But I think that, you know, the real wall of death was a bowl-shaped thing that a motorcycle daredevil would cycle around faster and faster until he was horizontal. A friend of mine used to do it, in fact, which is another inspiration for the song.
Could you just do some of that for us?
It's
such a great song.
I could do all of it if you want.
Oh, sure.
I could do it backwards. Let me ride on the wall of death one more time. Let me ride on the wall of death one more time. You can waste your time on the other rides. This is the nearest to being alive. Oh, let me take my chances on the wall of death. You can go with the crazy people in the crooked house. You can fly away on the rocket, a spin in the mouse. The tunnel of love might amuse you, and Noah's Ark might confuse you, but let me take my chances on the wall of death.
up all the world is far from me. On the wall of death, it's the nearest to being free. Oh, you're going nowhere when you ride on the carousel. And maybe you're strong, but what's the good of ringing a bell? The switchback will make you crazy. Beware of the bearded lady. Oh, let me take my chances on the wall of death.
Richard Thompson, thank you so much for performing for us. It was terrific. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Singer, songwriter, and guitarist Richard Thompson. In the next few days, Thompson will perform in Princeton, New Jersey, Northampton, Massachusetts, Tarrytown, New York, and Englewood, New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. This is NPR, National Public Radio. I'm Terry Gross. Join me for interviews on the arts, entertainment, and the issues of the day on Fresh Air.